Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll start with the front page article from the Wednesday, April 17th edition, headlined, ADL says Connecticut saw 170% rise in anti-Semitic incidents. This front page article by Jordan Nathaniel Fenster. A swastika was found carved in the Darien train station in October. Anti-Semitic propaganda was found in several towns across the state, including Glastonbury, Danbury, Trumbull, and Stamford. An Israeli flag was stolen in Wilton in November. These were just a few of the 184 anti-Semitic incidents the Anti-Defamation League said were recorded in Connecticut in 2023, an increase of 170% from the year before. That's a steeper increase than the ADL tracked nationwide. In all, the organization tracked 8,873 incidents nationwide that it regards as anti-Semitic in 2023, a 140% increase over 2022. Of them, 5,204 took place after October 7th, when Palestinian militants of Hamas attacked Israel, beginning a months-long war that has yet to end. In the three-month period between October 7th and the end of 2023, ADL recorded more incidents nationwide than in any full year on record since the organization began collecting data on anti-Semitic incidents in 1979. Across the country, there were 3,162 anti-Semitic incidents that included references to Israel or Zionism in 2023, compared to 241 in 2022. In Connecticut, the ADL said there were anti-Semitic incidents in 82 communities, including 25 bomb threats at synagogues, 72 incidents at publicly owned areas such as parks and train stations, and 17 incidents on college campuses. Of the 184 total incidents in Connecticut, there were 115 recorded incidents of harassment and 69 incidents of vandalism. That's above the total number of anti-Semitic incidents recorded by the ADL in Connecticut over the previous 4 years combined. Between 2019 and 2022, the organization recorded 163 anti-Semitic incidents in the state, the highest in 2022. It has been a really challenging time, said ADL Connecticut Regional Director Stacy Sobel. The staggering increase is a message that we really need to be paying attention to the increase in hate and particularly anti-Semitism in our communities, in our state, and the nation. Sobel believes that children are accessing hate speech and anti-Semitic messages on social media platforms, often independent of their families. We sometimes have parents come to us crying and upset because their child was a perpetrator of an anti-Semitic act in school, she said. They're like, we don't teach our children this. This is not who we are. What is going on? Why is my child saying this? Why is my child doing this? It's a very confusing time for families. Included in the ADL's audit are both criminal and non-criminal acts of harassment and intimidation, distribution of hate propaganda, threats and slurs, as well as vandalism and assault. There were no recorded anti-Semitic assaults in Connecticut, though nationwide the number of assault incidents increased by 45% to 161, according to the report. Also on today's front page, state law on school racial balance may get an overhaul. This article is by Alex Putterman and Jessica Sims. Connecticut's controversial law regarding racial balance in local school districts could be in for an overhaul. Under a bill that is advanced out of two legislative committees, the state's education department would study potential changes to the law, with enforcement paused until the review is complete. That would mean the towns of Fairfield, Greenwich, West Hartford, and Hamden, who each have at least one school out of compliance with the law, would be off the hook, at least temporarily, from explaining to state officials how they plan to better integrate their school systems. State Representative Jennifer Leeper of Fairfield was responsible for the provision regarding racial balance, which is included in a broader education bill. Leeper said Friday she's grown frustrated with the existing racial balance law, which requires non-white students be distributed relatively evenly across a school district instead of concentrated in certain schools. Typically, the schools out of compliance with the law are those in majority white towns that have a significant number of non-white students. Leeper argued racial imbalance in some schools largely reflected issues around zoning, including where people choose to live, where people can afford to live, where we allow for more diversified housing stock. Under the proposed bill, the Education Department would study the effectiveness of existing racial balance policies, assess how those policies have affected students of color, and propose alternative methods for correcting racial imbalances. State Representative Jeff Curry of East Hartford, who co-chairs the legislature's Education Committee, said pausing enforcement of the racial balance law would give the state time to examine the law and then be able to come back and see how to best make decisions at the local level. Under the new proposal, the study would be due by January 1, 2026. Connecticut's racial balance law, passed in 1969 and updated several times through the decades, requires that each public school in a given district fall within 25 percentage points of the overall district's share of white and non-white students. If a town is 70% white, for instance, each individual public school there must be between 45 and 95% white. Districts with at least one school out of compliance with the law are required to submit and implement plans on how they plan to achieve better balance moving forward. Over the years, the law has drawn criticism from numerous directions. Officials in districts affected by the law often complain that it forces them to move kids from their neighborhood schools, creating unnecessary disruption. Some integration advocates, meanwhile, have wondered why the state enforces racial balance only within a given school district, as opposed to regionally. Those who support the law typically acknowledge its limitations, but argue state oversight is necessary to keep districts from confining students of color to one or two schools, while leaving other buildings most entirely white. In practice, the racial balance law tends to affect only a narrow subset of towns, those with a substantial number of non-white students, but not enough that they're spread across the school district. Last year, the state reported 5 schools out of balance, 2 in Greenwich, and 1 in each in Fairfield, West Hartford, and Hamden, as well as 20 additional schools in impending imbalance, meaning that they were close to the imbalance threshold. Some of those schools have been out of compliance on and off for decades, submitting plan after plan to state officials, but nonetheless failing to achieve proper balance. At a recent meeting of the State Board of Education, officials from Greenwich criticized the racial balance law, defending the district's diversity and its level of integration. "We have diversity within our schools, and maybe it doesn't look like diversity with respect to one's outward appearance, but the diversity and culture goes beyond just that," said Karen Kowalski, chair of the town's Board of Education. Charlene Russell Tucker, the state's education commissioner, responded by noting the legislature's proposed bill, saying she didn't know if it would pass, but that if it does, it would guide our action with regard to racial balance. In written testimony submitted to the legislature, Russell Tucker didn't weigh in for or against the proposal, but said the Education Department will attempt to conduct such a study that examines the strategies implemented by Connecticut's districts to remedy racial imbalance, evaluate their effectiveness and cost benefits, and explore other alternatives. The proposed bill passed out of the Education Committee in mid-March, then out of the Appropriations Committee in early April. It now advances to the broader legislature, which has until May 8th to act on it. Elsewhere, in Stamford, a man is acquitted of Westport sex assault and is convicted of a lesser charge. This front page article by Pat Tomlinson. A jury has acquitted a Bridgeport man of felony sexual assault. but convicted him on a related misdemeanor over accusations that he forced a fellow patient into a sexual act at a Westport psychiatric facility in 2016. Mark DiPietro was found not guilty of first-degree sexual assault, a Class B felony that carries a prison sentence of up to 20 years. The jury did convict the 30-year-old of fourth-degree sexual assault, a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by up to 364 days in prison. As DiPietro, his mother and attorney, Frank Bellavacqua, watched in a fourth-floor courtroom at the State Superior Court in Stanford on Monday afternoon, the jury foreman delivered the verdict following only a couple hours of deliberation. Bellavacqua said DiPietro and his family are extremely happy about the felony acquittal. He said the DiPietro family was willing to accept the fourth-degree sexual assault conviction, though DiPietro himself was disappointed at the result. Bellavacqua added that his client has maintained his innocence for the past 8 years. He never wavered about that, Bellavacqua said. Echoing comments made during his closing arguments Monday morning, Bellavacqua said he believes that whatever happened behind that door on April 23, 2016 at the St. Vincent's Behavioral Health Services campus in Westport was consensual in nature. I feel that she regretted what she did after the fact, but that she knew what she was doing, Bellavacqua claimed in the wake of the verdict. I feel bad for her, and so does my client. He has no ill will toward her, but he did not want to be blamed for an act that she performed, then later regretted. Assistant State Attorney Margaret Muscati, who tried the case, declined to comment on the verdict. The case, which has been pending at the State Superior Court since August 2016, revolved around accusations made by an 18-year-old in April 2016 that DiPietro sexually assaulted her while the two were staying at the St. Vincent's Behavioral Health Services campus in Westport. DiPietro had been civilly committed to the Westport facility 10 days before the alleged incident. During her closing arguments on Monday, Muscati recounted the woman's account of the events of April 23, 2016, reminding them of her testimony earlier in the trial regarding a conversation with DiPietro about her poetry that led to sexual overtures and the alleged assault. In her arguments, Muscati drew jurors' attention to the testimony from John White, a St. Vincent's mental health worker who described how the alleged victim in the case, a bubbly, happy-go-lucky person, normally seemed sad and different on the day she reported the sexual assault. It was like she was moving in slow motion, Muscati said, quoting White's description of the woman on the day of the alleged assault. DiPietro was arrested in August 2016 on charges of first-degree and fourth-degree sexual assault following an investigation that began several months earlier. According to his four-page arrest affidavit, Westport police were called to the psychiatric hospital when the female patient told a nurse about the alleged assault. The woman reportedly told police she tried to get away from DiPietro, who is diagnosed with schizophrenia, but he would not let her go. DiPietro denied doing anything to the woman and at first claimed to police that he did not know her, according to reports. But police obtained the video showing the two sitting in the hallway of the hospital before he allegedly grabbed the woman by the wrist and pulled her into his room. Monday's verdict marks the end of a case that sat dormant for years after DiPietro was repeatedly found unfit to stand trial. DiPietro is scheduled to be sentenced on June 25th. While DiPietro has been held in custody longer than the maximum sentence for the crime he was convicted of Monday, he will likely not be released following his sentencing, as he remains civilly committed, according to Bellavacqua. Also out of Westport, a fourth time is the charm as downtown Westport parking plan gets an okay. This article by Kayla Mulchler. After months in the making, Parker Harding Plaza finally has a revamp plan ready to move forward. The Planning and Zoning Commission recently approved a plan to repave and remap parking spaces in the plaza, also paving over some of Jessup Green to make up for the lost parking that will come with redesigned spaces in the plaza. This is the fourth rendition of the plan in the last year. There's absolutely no reason to delay, First Selectwoman Jennifer Tooker said about approving the project. It is the gateway to our downtown, and it is a dangerous, non-compliant, and poorly functioning parking lot. Commissioners Paul Leibowitz, John Bolton, Patrizia Zuccaro, and Michael Calise voted in favor, while Nicole Laskin, Michael Kammeyer, and Neil Cohn did not. Since the parking lot needs to be repaved, there are regulations that need to be followed regarding parking space size, Public Works Director Pete Rakowicz said. The plans have been proposed to make parking spaces larger, become compliant with the Americans and with Disabilities Act and Fire Code, mitigate flooding, improve circulation, and add green space. The parking count goes from 214 non-conforming spots to 174 conforming spots in Parker Harding Plaza. Rakowicz said he said that many of the current spots are too small to even accommodate small cars. Under the new plan, all parking spaces will be standard size. After an October meeting revealing the lost spaces, the Downtown Plan Implementation Committee and administration met to determine where spots could be added. Jessup Green had space to add 42 spots on its hill. Those spaces at Jessup Green will be built before Parker Harding's reconstruction, providing an additional place for people to park during the time, Rakowicz said. Jessup Road will also be realigned and parking will be added there. Once Parker Harding is rebuilt, Rakowicz said, the southern portion of Taylor Lot would be changed to green space to make up for what is lost. This is an increase in green space by 850 square feet. If the police and EMS station moves to a conjoined facility with the fire department in the future, which is another plan in the works, even more green space can be added there, Rakowicz said. And in other news out of Westport, this also by Kayla Mutchler, new rules bar public from Westport campuses during school hours. Residents will no longer be able to use school properties during certain hours of the day. Though this upset some residents who garden or walk their dogs on the properties, many officials said the change was needed for security reasons. There isn't a school in Fairfield County that we can go wider that allows people on school grounds during school hours. For most schools, you can't get past the sidewalk, Police Chief Fodi Koskinas said. The Board of Select Women voted April 10th to approve the new guidelines, which had previously been approved by Parks and Recreation. The Board of Education, Police Department, and Parks and Recreation worked together to determine the exact boundaries of each school campus and the hours in which non-school members would be allowed on them. With the approval, Parks and Recreation rules now state that the campuses are not accessible to people who are not students, staff, or invited guests between 7:30 a.m. and 4:15 p.m. on school days. The Board of Education already has a policy prohibiting people from being on school grounds during school hours, but there is some confusion in the community surrounding where that entails, said Parks and Recreation Director Jennifer Fava. For safety and security purposes, school grounds include the entire campus for each school and recreational facilities adjacent to each school. This modification also includes the community gardens at Long Lots Elementary School. Community gardens members could previously garden during school hours, but can't anymore under the new guidelines. Koskinas said the police department has looked at schools across Connecticut to determine best practices for security. The department realizes not everybody is a threat, but they want to minimize the amount of people on a campus at a given time because of school and parent concerns. Police want a uniform policy to determine who exactly can be on school grounds during the day, he said. Superintendent of Schools Thomas Scarice said it is odd to have public access to a school campus during school hours in 2024. He said it should be reserved for personnel, students, faculty, and people who are invited. Scarice said his main concern is for the Staples High School and Bedford Middle School campus. It's a popular area for people to walk their dogs during the day, And during the fall, a physical education was bit by a dog while his class was outside. Those borders need to be maintained, he said. The school security officers are able to enforce the borders rather than faculty who should be attending the classes, Scurrie said. Some residents expressed disdain about not being able to walk their dogs on the grounds anymore and used community gardens during the day. Stephen Parnes, speaking on behalf of some dog walkers in town, said they were not aware of these changes. Some use Wakeman Park near Bedford Middle School as the only one near that side of town, which wouldn't be allowed with the new boundaries. Parnes said that the dog walkers there would notice someone suspicious, as there is a typical group who uses that park. Parent Sandra Rose said parents don't take pleasure in telling people they can't walk strollers, walk their dogs, or go running near the properties, while they also don't like that students must practice active shooter drills. But this is the state of the world. Resident and community garden members Tony Simonetti said garden members could be considered invited guests and would be happy to report suspicious activities too. In news out of Norwalk, Norwalk's Target construction begins. This front page article by Catherine Lutke. While the facade of 680 Connecticut Avenue has not changed too much, crews have begun to work to peel away the blue paint of Walmart, making way for Target's red. We're excited to bring an easy, affordable, and convenient shopping experience to new guests in the Norwalk community with this new Target store, a spokesperson from Target said. The expansive parking lot outside the old Walmart has sat empty since November 3, 2023, when the store closed its doors at 680 Connecticut Avenue. For months, the site remained quiet, with few changes in the front of the building. Now, work has begun, and crews have demolished the side wall and part of the back wall of 680 Connecticut Avenue. Target is adjusting the location of the loading dock in the rear of the building, redoing the facade, and refinishing the interior of the building. In January, the City of Norwalk issued building permits for site work to begin. Target has not revealed when the 117,215 square foot store is expected to be opened. As we get closer to opening the store, we'll have more specific details to share, including how the shopping experience will be tailored to serve local guests and the grand opening date, the spokesperson said. Target plans to shift the main entrance of the store to the right of the building, away from Home Goods, and alter the facade. Once open, Norwalk's Target will join Stamford's location, Trumbull's location, and Danbury's location, which just opened at the Danbury Fair Mall. Just off Route 1, Target will be down the street from Costco, which is expanding its parking, and across the street from Connecticut's first Wegmans. Costco recently demolished the old Doubletree Hotel, making way for an expanded parking deck and a standalone tire center. Wegmans is building its two-story parking deck before beginning on the main supermarket and two retail buildings. In coordination with the city, Wegmans is providing five new adaptive traffic signals to ease the flow of traffic surrounding these popular stores. In news out of Wilton, the police say a man posed as an FBI agent. This article by Josh LaBella. A New Haven man has been arrested after he allegedly impersonated an FBI agent in a phone call to the Wilton Police Department, officials say. In a release on Monday, the Wilton Police Department said Perry Charnas was charged with criminal impersonation and two counts of second-degree false incident report. Police say Charnas attempted to impersonate an FBI agent after a series of phone calls to the department in October of 2022. They said he then called to falsely report a domestic incident at an address in Wilton. Police said Charnas was taken into custody on April 8th by officers in New Haven. According to court documents, Charnas was released on a promise to appear and is scheduled to enter a plea in State Superior Court in Stamford on June 19th. In other news from today's paper, Stephen Sondheim's Roxbury House sells for $3.25 million. This article by Andrew DeRosa. The Roxbury House of celebrated composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim has sold for $3.25 million, according to Clem Real Estate, which brokered the property. The property sold for its listed price. It was initially listed for sale in November. We were extremely privileged to be chosen to handle such a wonderful home that was cared for by such an extraordinary icon. We are thrilled that the market responded so well to this wonderful property, said Graham Clem, president and broker of Clem Real Estate, in a statement. Clem previously told Hearst, Connecticut, that his company purposefully kept the address off of websites in order to protect the safety of the house and prevent it from becoming a tourist attraction. Sondheim resided at the Roxbury Estate from 1984 until his death in 2021, according to town property records, leaving it to his husband, Jeff Romley, and assistant, Stephen Clark. Sondheim lived in the Connecticut house throughout most of the pandemic, according to an article in Curbed. In addition to his Roxbury house, Sondheim also had a townhouse on 49th Street in New York City, which Zillow reports as being sold last month for $7 million. A 1792 estate situated on approximately 9 acres of land, Sondheim purchased the Roxbury property when it was just a small farmhouse before expanding it to its current state. The house now has 3 bedrooms, 3.5 bathrooms, paneled library, and an open living area with a vaulted wooden ceiling and stone fireplace. The house also has an adjoining 1-bedroom pool house, pool and hot tub. And in an article by Abby Weiss, a fireball was seen from Connecticut. More than 100 witnesses reported seeing a fireball shoot across the sky from Connecticut and other areas in the northeastern United States on Saturday evening. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration Meteor Watch Facebook page reported the fireball sighting on Sunday. People in Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, New Hampshire, North Carolina, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia have also reported seeing a bright meteor at around 9 p.m., according to submissions to the American Meteor Society, a website that tracks astronomical sightings. Viewers from East Haven, Fairfield, and Northford were among the nearly 140 witnesses. It took me by surprise how bright and apparent it was. It was partly cloudy outside, but the moon was also visible, a witness from Fairfield wrote. According to an analysis in the report, the fireball became visible 50 miles above Mamaroneck in Westchester County, NASA wrote. It moved in the northern direction at 38,000 miles per hour before disintegrating at an altitude of 30 miles above Norvin Green State Forest in New Jersey. The fireball was not associated with a currently active meteor shower, NASA wrote in the post on Sunday. According to the AMS meteor shower calendar, the active period for the Lyrids meteor shower began on Monday and will last through April 29th. The meteors from the Lyrids shower are best seen in the northern hemisphere at dawn. The Lyrids are expected to peak on the night of April 21st to 22nd, when the moon will be 96% full. The fireball sightings on Saturday are among the multiple celestial events that occurred in Connecticut and surrounding states last week, including the solar eclipse on Monday. Last Wednesday, people from Connecticut and other states reported seeing a green fireball last Wednesday morning at around 3:44 a.m. Finally today in Life Tributes, Robert Francis Avery Sr. died peacefully on April 13th. Kevin J. Gaffney of Bridgewater died peacefully at home on April 14th. And Carl M. Parenti of Norwalk also passed away on Sunday, April 14th. And finally, Patricia M. Weaver, formerly of Norwalk, passed away on March 30th at her home in New Hampshire. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, April 17th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.